Good evening. You're listening to special election coverage on KRBD Ketchikan. My name's Layla Carey, and for the next hour, we'll be talking with the three House District 36 candidates. They're in the studio with me now. Welcome to incumbent independent Representative Dan Ortiz, Republican Bob Sievertson, and Constitution Party candidate Kenneth Shaw. Good evening.
Good evening.
And this is a live call-in show, so listeners from all of the communities within House District 36 are welcome to participate. If you have a question for the candidates, the local number is 225-9655 or dial 1-800-557-5723 if you're calling from Prince of Wales Island or Wrangell. But first, let's hear an opening statement from each of the candidates, starting with Mr. Shaw. What would you like voters to know about you?
I guess the number one thing I want voters to recognize is that probably is my biggest difference, the biggest difference between myself and the other candidates, in that it seems to be all about taxes during this election. And I just would like for voters to realize that that is not my goal in this. I think there's other ways to deal with this fiscal issue, and that's what I want to address tonight.
Okay.
And thank you, Layla, for having me tonight.
Absolutely. And Dan Ortiz.
Thank you, Layla. First of all, I again like to acknowledge my opponents here tonight for their service in the community and for what they've done in our local community. They are indeed worthy opponents, and I appreciate them putting their names forward and being a part of this race. Let's start, however, by talking about what this election is really about. It's about creating a situation, voting to create a situation where we can begin to solve our most pressing problem, and that is our fiscal situation. If voters elect me as their District 36 representative, what they're voting for is a representative who will first and foremost represent them. That's my job. I think in my first 2 years in office, I've done exactly that. I've gone out. I've sought opinions from a variety of sources. I've done it through surveys. I've done it by going door to door. I've done it by communicating with letters to the editor. I've just been adamant, and I think I've raised the bar quite a bit in terms of constituent communication. Because in the end, it's not about what Representative Ortiz thinks. It's about Representative Ortiz going out and seeking out the opinions, seeking out the perspectives of the voters that he represents. This particular election, if I'm elected, will put me in a bipartisan majority. It will be a majority that number one responsibility that we all agree to when we join will be to address the fiscal situation, to address it, to take it on, to make the tough votes, to make the tough decisions so that we can put the state on a fiscal path of sustainability. That's the number one commitment to being a part of this majority, and I think everybody recognizes the need for that to happen. This bipartisan majority will be a much more friendly majority to coastal issues and to rural communities than the existing Republican majority. The facts are clear. If you look at the last budgets that have been passed by the Republican majority, they were much more shaded towards the oil industry, oil tax credits, and there wasn't a lot of perspective, a lot of concern shown for rural, for coastal communities throughout Alaska. This bipartisan majority will be much different than that. So there's a lot at stake. And I hope to have the opportunity to be a part of the solution. And I'm asking voters that they return me to office in this next election.
Thank you. And Bob Sievertson.
thank you again for the opportunity of being here. And it is an important election. I've been getting some of the same calls that Dan probably has from organization. There's a move afoot, and there always is, well before the election, of the legislators trying to figure out what that organization is going to look like. And again, I said earlier today that there was a good article published in regards to that. And I'm still in the belief that there will be a Republican-led majority. It may be some kind of a coalition, but we had a coalition before. We had Democrats with Republicans in the majority, and they were rural Democrats, some from the Arctic region. But, again, I think you want to be in the room for those discussions, and I still feel that if we go with what's historically happened, the Republicans have been in control. And they have been responsible. They cut $1.7 billion out of the budget. They listen to their constituents. I've heard across the state that people want smaller government, and that takes cuts. And those are some really, really tough things to do. Early, the cuts were probably a little more simple. We had some big projects in the capital budget that went away. We had positions that weren't filled by people that we were able to cut and reduce. But now we're getting down to the bone where we're going to have to look at programs and people that are in jobs right now. And I don't think that the only thing we're going to do is be able to cut the budget. We're going to have to look for a lot of different efficiencies within the departments, things that we can do to trim money, use technology, things like that. But I don't want to go to Juneau with the first option of starting to look at taxes. I think that we got to figure out what that magic number of the budget's going to be for this year. Probably $4 billion. That's a $300 million cut. That's pretty sizable. And then we'll move forward from there.
Okay, thank you. And this is a call-in show, so if you have a question for our candidates over the next hour, give us a call now, 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. This is a two-part question that was submitted earlier today by a listener. Do you have an opinion about the viability of the state of Alaska developing a natural gas pipeline? And what is your opinion of this as part of a long-term financial plan for the state? And this time we will start with Dan Ortiz.
Yes, this is something that the governor has put front and center of his agenda. He would like to see a gas pipeline that hopefully will, not hopefully, I think in the long term, we're looking at a potential of $1.3 billion of new revenue added to the state's coffer. The key term there, however, is long term. And that's where, that's where the rubber is going to hit the road, whether or not this is going to be a project where the state takes on the primary responsibility, or whether or not the big three oil companies will be equal partners in the project. Lately, it seems like the state might be looking at perhaps taking on more responsibility, which will mean financing part of that project. And that's where the fiscal situation for the state is so important. By us not adopting a fiscal plan, we have seen our bond rating for the state of Alaska go down. And the end result of that is when we borrow money, it's going to cost us more. That's just one big example about how not having a fiscal plan has hurt the state. And an example of where the Republican majority failed in the responsibility to do what was fiscally responsible for the state of Alaska.
Thank you. And Mr. Shaw?
I do agree with Dan on the fact that I would like to see this pipeline happen. Absolutely. That would just be more eggs in our basket eventually to draw from. It's common sense to me. after we get our financial house in order. It's just not even worth bringing up at this point until we truly have our ducks in a row. I think we've got an awful lot of work to do before we could actually make it happen. And I'm anxious to actually to get to Juneau to help make that happen. I would really like to see that happen in the next several years. But I want to concentrate first on actually reducing the size of government a bit. Here we go with cutting again and taxes. I don't want to talk about just cuts. I would actually like to see a bit of a reduction in the size of government. That usually increases private sector. It's going to help all the way around. If we can do that, we will have a little extra money to spend. We can start thinking about pipelines, big long-term projects. I'd love to see that happen. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson.
Yeah, that's a natural resource that we're underutilizing right now. We're just pumping it back into the ground. We have a large volume of natural gas. The market has to be right. And then, as has been mentioned before, the construction costs going out for those loans and our present situation, we're going to have to wait on that a little bit. But I don't think that we should stop thinking about it or not think outside of the box. With the opening of the Arctic, it might be more reasonable to build that line going north. They're going to have to build ships to transport anyway. I don't know if there's enough natural gas freighters around to move the volume that we're talking about. So if they're icebreakers, then maybe they can move it out of the Arctic easier, shorter pipeline. I'm not sure. But we still have to think that the biggest cost of some of this is the liquefaction plant and how we manage that. So there's a lot of moving pieces. We've tried to come to a consensus. We were at one time going through Canada, and then we were going to go bullet down. I mean, it bounced all over the place. We have to figure out the plan and settle on it and keep moving forward on it. It'll happen in time. It's just a matter of where it's going to fall in our future, because we don't know how long it's going to take us to get out of the deficit situation we're in now. We don't know what the oil prices are going to do moving forward. And in the near future, I don't think oil prices are going to save us. We're going to have to rely on our own resources.
Okay, thank you very much. And there's not as many ballot propositions this year as there were last time around, but how do you plan to vote on the ballot proposition that would automatically register people to vote when they apply for their PFD? And this time we'll start with Bob Sievertson.
Well, I've read a number of different thoughts on that. I think it's a reasonable idea, but the fact that it's going to take, hundreds of millions of dollars to get it implemented, and then they're talking about $300 million to manage it to the year, and we're going to be growing government, and I don't think we can afford that. So we got to look at the cost of providing such a program. I think it has merit, but again, everything boils down to dollars these days, so you really have to look at see where that's going to end up at.
And Mr. Ortiz?
Being that I come from a background of teaching government, teaching history, and almost every day talking about the importance of citizens' involvement, people's involvement in the democratic process, it seems to me that if we can integrate registering for the PFD to voter registration and make that a seamless two-step process or two eggs in one basket solution, it makes a lot of sense. Obviously, if the cost is in the hundreds of millions, we have to look at that. I'm wondering where maybe, we heard hundreds of millions.
I don't know if it's hundreds of millions. Probably hundreds of thousands.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Okay. So in any case, I tend to be, I plan to vote yes on that proposition.
And Mr. Shaw.
I've heard it was $1 million, but, we've got numbers all around the table. I'm not in favor of it. I guess my number one reason is the fact it's tough to recoup that much money. We're not getting our bang for the buck, so to speak, for that kind of thing. Most people, including myself, tend to, when they move to a new town or new state, you know, they deal with those things. When they get their driver's license, they go take care of the voting registrations. Everybody's pretty tuned in to get, that's going to, it's pretty tuned in to getting those things done. So just adding that to the PFD, I don't see it really having a lot of, I don't see a lot of good from it, not with the amount of money that it's going to cost. So no, I'm really not in favor of it.
Okay. And this next question is a question from a listener. Alaska's economy overall is based on oil, and the local economy in Ketchikan depends heavily on tourism. How would you work to diversify and provide more stability to the state and local economies? And this time we'll start with Dan Ortez.
Excellent question, and one that, in my mind, starts with the enhancement and the development, the enhancement of our existing fishing industry, and then the development and hopefully state cooperation in promoting mariculture. The market for Alaskan seafood products is a solid market. The demand for our products is out there worldwide. And when I think about our mariculture industry and the potential of that, it's almost limitless. What we do need to do, however, is start to invest in the infrastructure and hopefully having the state be a more cooperative partner in helping individual farmers to begin developing their resources, you know, and being able to, you know, finally get to the production end of it where we can actually start to sell these things. It's a several, you know, probably a good 10-year process before we get there, but the market's almost limitless, and to me, that's one of the best ways we here in Southeast Alaska can diversify our economy. And in a sense, it's greatly augmenting an existing industry, so in that sense, it's not diversifying, but it's a whole new area, and to me, that's one of the biggest things we can do to help ourselves.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson?
Well, diversification is always best for your economy. If you're not, if you have all three legs of the stool, say, in your region or your community, it pays dividends. When one is struggling, the other two can hold them up, and the people have something to plan on in the community. Dan's right. The mariculture industry is a real potential right here in Southeast. They have investment and infrastructure issues. They have new industry capacity issues. They have workforce development issues in regards to that. And there's, of course, a number of regulations and hurdles that we have to come over through that. And so, you know, it boils down to being able to access and utilize the natural resources that we have. And we have a lot of federal oversight. We have a lot of regulations that hamper us. And so we need to take those on and address them one by one until we get to a situation where we have the ability, as many states down below did, in order to prosper. That means putting the land into private ownership and Alaska ownership. And that's where we struggle. We have resources. We have all kinds of resources. But they're tied up in federal hands right now. And when you talk about, you know, the local industries. We look down here, we have a lot of advantage. We have timber, we have fish, we have some mining going on, the tourism industry, we have, marine manufacturing. And so that's what we really look at and pay attention to. And the people in the north, they have mining, which they really look to. There is fishing out in the Gulf areas and on the chain, But a lot of them depend on oil, just like we would depend on our industry. So I don't want to paint them with a bad brush. It's a resource that they depend on for their livelihood. And those legislators that are in those areas are going to support the industry that supports our community, just like we are going to do, and I have done down here. And the same thing with Dan. Dan supported those industries. And so it's just a matter of, geographic location and the industries in your area.
Okay. And Mr. Shaw?
Excuse me. I do think we need to use all of our resources. That's going to help with our fiscal problem all the way around, keep us from relying on oil so much. I think we should have been doing this before. It probably would have helped, but that's here or there. It's done. The mariculture, absolutely. Timber, even. I'd like to see a little resurgence in timber, responsibly managed. I'm good with that. All of Alaska has so many resources. It's crazy for us to not be using them now. We shouldn't have to rely on outside money, so to speak. I think we should have been doing it before. Like I said, I'd like to see all of our resources being used. And I think we can. I think we will if oil stays down like it is. I think we're not going to have a lot of choice. Maybe that will drive the state to start working on getting our resources, the infrastructure built up, also get the resources utilized. I'd really love to see that. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're coming up on almost halfway through. An hour goes very quickly. So if you out there have a burning question for our candidates, go ahead and give us a call, 225-9655 locally or 1-800-557-5723 if you're on Prince of Wales Island or in Wrangell. And speaking of outside money, there's been a lot of outside money coming into this election, more than we've seen in the past. What are your thoughts on this new-to-us development? And this time we'll start with Mr. Sievertson.
Thank you. Yeah, again, as Dan has mentioned, these races are fairly important, and there has been a lot of PAC money from outside of our district. There is one group that has been supporting me that is an independent PAC. And I want to make sure that people understand that independent PACs work separately from the campaigns. But I've done all my fundraising right here in the district. I do have some different monies out of Juneau. I have some Alaska Chamber out of Anchorage, those types of things. And I know that there's been a lot of labor PAC money put into my opponent's race, about, over $20,000. He's probably had more PAC money than I may have in my own campaign, but that's just the way it is. When you start running for an office, there are definitely PAC organizations that are Democrat, independent, or Republican-minded. And they're gonna donate money to candidates that they think have a chance of winning.
And Mr. Shaw?
Well, personally, I'm amazed at the amount of PAC money, outside money, that pours into elections. Granted, I'm a little new to this. I'm learning fast that there's some incredible money out there that go to mostly big parties now. Me being basically a third party, I don't have quite so many issues with it. I've pretty much done this on a shoestring. As long as they're fair, I'm good with it. I mean, people want to see their man win. That's the way it works. You have certain groups that want to pull for their candidate, regardless of the party. I mean, they put their money where they feel it will be best spent. That's the way it works in politics today.
And Mr. Ortiz.
Yeah, this is an issue. There's no doubt about it. my campaign has taken a lot of money from around the state, and it has come from a lot of labor organizations. There's no question about that. One of the things, though, that I'm very proud of is that those people who support me, the few PACs that support me, and my own campaign have never come out with a negative attack ad towards either of my opponents. We have not come out with one. And I'm proud of that. I believe that campaigns should be based on support of the individual that you're supporting in a positive way. If you say positive things about the person that you're supporting, that's great. And that's a good thing. But negative campaign style flyers like we've seen in this campaign, I don't think Southeast Alaska has a tradition of that, and we're community-based, small communities where we all know each other, and it just seems like there's no place for it in our communities, in the communities of District 36. And it's just a bad trend. There was a statement earlier in the campaign that, well, this is just the way things are done now. But no, they don't have to be that way. There's nothing to say that they have to be that way. It just takes people standing up and saying, no, this is not the way we do things. And I hope that can be the case in the future.
Thank you. And kind of on the same subject, and I am going to start again with Bob on this one. It's a related question. We have had seen some negative advertising from outside organizations that are not affiliated with the campaigns, but are working to influence the election. And so, Bob, this is specific to you, but other candidates can comment. Does the negative advertising help or hurt you in this particular race?
It definitely hurts me. And I've publicly said that I don't approve of the negative advertising. Somebody on the street probably has more of an opportunity to call those people direct because I can't by state law. But I've actually published an apology to Dan in the paper in regards to that, even though I had no responsibility for it. I didn't agree with it. So, I think it's generated in an area that it may be the norm, but it doesn't work here.
Okay. And Mr. Shaw, did you want to respond?
Well, I don't approve of negative ads either. I don't think anybody would admit to that. But it is, that's politics. I mean, look at national politics. They seem to try to outdo one another with negative ads. It's just a big part of politics in general. I don't approve of it, but, you know, if you're going to get into politics, it's about thick skin, you know. I've heard a few hateful things towards my campaign, not over the air or anything like that, but just in general, in person. You know, I just deal with it. You go on, you do your best, you make your choices, brush them off, and walk away. At least that's my way of dealing with it. You see it a lot. Any campaign, you see some of it. It's just part of it. I try to roll with it.
And Mr. Ortiz?
I believe I already addressed the question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I
okay.
was wondering if you wanted to address it far as helping or hurting the campaign.
I guess we'll find out on election night, won't we? That'll be the question.
One of the things is that I just had an individual come down that lives in the Anchorage area. And she talks about the races that were going on up there, and it just it's so negative, it's unbelievable. And there's a lot of money being spent by probably some people that support us, but it's commonplace there.
Okay, and this is a call-in show. If you have a question for our candidates, call 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. And I'm being handed a question right now, so let's see what this one is. How will you work to protect our watersheds, fisheries, resources, and mariculture industries? And this is from a Ketchikan resident who wishes to remain anonymous. And this time we will start with Mr. Shaw.
I think the state's doing a lot already to, at least they're really paying attention to watersheds, especially since we're having issues with Canada and watersheds coming out of Canada into our own state. You just have to have the proper government agencies paying attention and using common sense. You know, as some of the mines that we've had to deal with, some mines that want to open, obviously if they're going to dump toxic waste, then it's going to get into a watershed. Common sense dictates you just don't let it happen. I mean, it's as far as a particular way to prevent it, there's a lot of oversight already for that kind of thing. I think we just need to make sure we have quality people at the helm of those positions and make sure their job is done and done well. It's in place. We just need to make sure they follow through with it.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson?
Yeah, the transboundary issues are very important. And, you know, the state and British Columbia have been working in regards to that. There's an international joint committee and a boundaries water treaty in 1909 that talked about waters. But we shouldn't ever sacrifice one area or one industry over another. And I think that we need to get a special representative out of the federal government to deal with international issues in regards to this transboundary. We have yet to get the State Department to move on that, but I think we need to keep working on them. The Red Chris mine, you know, there's going to be, it's copper and gold. And what we've done right now is probably just considered a first step. We're going to look at some background information so we know what the baseline is, what we're looking at. But when the Mount Polley blowout happened, it was very obvious that the standard practices of stacking tailings didn't work in that particular area. And we have some of the same type of, characteristics in these new mines that may go on the major tributaries coming into southeast Alaska. We need to make sure that there's agreements on paper. We need to make sure that people are held accountable when we talk about this. We need to listen to the people that have these concerns. And we need to address all of their concerns before you even move forward with one of these. But again, since it's international, the State Department needs to come to the table and work with us on this so we can develop those treaties and make sure that whatever we do moving forward is in the best interest of Southeast Alaska and our industries.
Thank you. And Mr. Ortez.
Yeah, thank you, Leila. This is a big issue. Earlier in the night, we talked about the importance of trying to develop our mariculture industry. In order to do that, we need to make sure that our waterways remain pristine and that we have environments where mariculture and our existing fishing industry can continue to flourish. Last session, in my first session, I should say, as a legislator, I introduced a resolution dealing with transboundary mining. And that, I think, caught the attention of some folks and started to raise the awareness along with a few other things. And I applaud the Walker administration. This particular area was spearheaded by Lieutenant Governor Malott, where they engaged the BC government, and there were meetings held. Representatives from the BC government came to Southeast Alaska, and this was the springboard for some agreements between the state of Alaska and the BC government. But that's not going far enough, because what's at stake here is just in the Unic, Stikine, and Taku rivers alone, the McDowell group published a report that said $430 million of economic value, economic activity is generated out of those three rivers alone on an annual basis. Now, obviously, that's including the further processing and the further sale of processed goods. That's not just the raw fish value. But nevertheless, it's important part of our economy here in Southeast Alaska, so we need to do everything we can. And so I agree. Our congressional delegation has written a letter to the State Department asking Secretary of State Kerry to engage the government of Canada on this issue. We need to keep pressing until that happens. We also need to work, continue to work between ourselves as the state of Alaska and the government of BC, and work at that level as well. Because in the end, there's no amount of safeguard that you can put into place that can cover the value of an industry that should last into eternity as long as we're protecting those resources. So how can you put an X amount of dollar value on there and say, well, if something happens, this will compensate? That dollar is limitless in terms of what kind of value you can put on it. So it's so important that we do what we can at all levels to protect the number one economic driver of our economy already. And what I'm hoping to see is even a greater role for the fishing industry to play even a bigger role in our economy. And it's really important that we handle this issue of transboundary mining in the right way, in the best interest of Southeast Alaska, as best as we can. Because in the end, it is their territory. So, that's a fact. And we've got to acknowledge that and recognize that in the end, there's going to be limits.
Thank you. And we have about 20 minutes left, so if you have a question for our candidates, go ahead and give us a call at 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. And this next question was submitted earlier today by a listener. The borough manages the state-owned airport with the help of a state subsidy. How would you work to make sure the state won't push those expenses back onto the borough? And this time, we will start with Mr. Shaw.
Could I have that question again, please?
Sure. The borough manages the state-owned airport with the help of a state subsidy. How would you work to make sure the state won't push those expenses back onto the borough?
That is a good question. I think the state needs to keep an active role in those kind of things. I don't see actually the state trying to push all of that back on us. Number one, I don't believe we could afford it at this point. I think it would be a shot in the foot for the state. I just don't see it happening personally. I think it's like everything else in our government and our borough. We need to pay attention to our dollars, pay attention to management, how well things are run here, and really keep a tight lid on it next couple of years, especially. After that, I believe we will have, if we do things right and truly get to work on this money issue we have going on, there will be enough money to deal with these issues. Like I said, I don't think the state is going to push back much on this. I personally don't think they could afford it. We certainly couldn't afford it. It's going to cause a lot of problems. I believe they need to get back to the drawing board and deal with the and really deal with a lot of, best way to put it is waste in government. If we can deal with that, we will have the money to deal with things that we truly need, like an airport, schools. There's a lot of critical things that need to be dealt with, and airport's one of them, obviously. We can't drive. So, basically, I personally don't see that happening anytime soon. If we get our ducks in a row, we won't have to see it happen.
Thank you. And Mr. Ortiz?
Yes, I currently serve on the Transportation Committee in the legislature. I'm very familiar with the special relationship that the Ketchikan Gateway Borough has with the state in terms of the borough managing the airport as opposed to most of the rest of the airports in the state, where the state manages those airports. I know that Governor Walker sees this particular situation here in Ketchikan as positive for the state. He, I believe, wants to encourage or use Ketchikan and places like Ketchikan as a model for some of the other state-managed airports around the state. I agree with Mr. Shaw that I don't see the state changing that relationship, because that relationship where the borough currently manages the airport for some subsidy from the state is a much better deal for the state in comparison to when the state manages a whole airport and pays for all the costs of that management of that airport. I believe that Governor Walker is looking for ways to match what happens in Ketchikan to other places around the state.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson?
Yeah, I do believe Governor Walker would like to use the agreement here in Ketchikan as a model, because it does work well. But if you've ever been in Manager Bockhorst's office, he has the key to the airport sitting on his desk. So the reality of it is, if they try to send it back onto the community, who'll give the key back to the state? So, I mean, it's their airport. So I think that's a reality. So I don't think they want to upset that. But I remember when TSA started costing the airport a considerable amount of money that we had to go back. I think it was like, $400,000 or something. And we had to go back, and it took a while to get that agreement. It was a cost that was, it came as a mandate that we had no control over. And we needed the state to step up on that, and we finally got that agreement. But it is a state airport, so I don't think they're going to push that cost onto us without realizing that they jeopardized the agreement.
From what I understand, the subsidy costs a lot less than managing the airport would for the state. So, and my next question is the state's budget, as we all know, has been a little tight the last few years, and seems to be getting tighter. So what would be your strategy for promoting local interests in the legislature? And this time we'll start with Mr. Ortiz.
Could you clarify that question a bit, what you mean by local interests in relationship to the state budget? What do you mean by that?
Well, I guess I mean things that are of extreme importance to people who live here in your region.
Okay. So, no question, the fiscal situation for the state is the number one issue by far. There is no doubt about it. Since I have been in office, the state has reduced its budget from $8 billion combined operating capital budget down to $4.3 billion. That's a 44% reduction in state expenditures. So we've done a lot of cutting, and we will probably need to cut some more. At the same time, we do need to remember what the impacts of those cuts are, whether they're on our own Pioneer Home programs, whether they're impacting our cruise ship passenger vessel tax monies, whether they're impacting our money for education. You know, these are all things that are important to our local community. There's no question about that. The Harbors program, as a part of the capital budget is an important thing that will help maintain our harbors throughout coastal Alaska. So as we move forward, we need to make sure that while reductions need to be continue to be a part of the solution, that we don't reduce ourselves to the point where we actually are counterproductive, and we actually end up losing more money than we gain. Fishing industry is an important local interest. I serve on the Fisheries Fish and Game Subfinance Committee. I've seen a reduction of 27% for funding for fish and game. We are at the point, I believe, where there's starting to be some negative impacts, significant negative impacts on fishermen themselves, because they're not being allowed perhaps to catch the maximum sustainable yield in certain areas where fish and game doesn't have enough people to get the data that they need to allow the maximum sustainable yield catch to take place. So what happens in the end? Fishermen make less money. There's less money taken in for the state in fish taxes. And where you're here, you're trying to save money by cutting fish and game. In the end, you're actually costing fishermen money, their families money, and the state money. So, yeah, I'm all about trying to protect the interests. And I think I know what those interests are. And I think I have a record of doing just that, protecting some of those interests that are so important to our region.
Thank you. And Mr. Shaw?
I still believe that we have a little room to cut without going overboard, without going too far, personally. I think just the size of the government itself, government's expensive. No matter how you look at it, government in itself is expensive. Much more expensive than private sector. I don't have all the answers, of course, but for now, between maybe a few more cuts, possibly looking into the inflation proofing, which is not needed now. I don't know that we talked about that earlier. Most of the inflation proofing that's been dumped into the PFD is not needed because of the vehicles the investments are placed in. It's almost already inflation-proofed. We're not putting all of our money into bonds, so to speak. So there, between that, some reserves and a little more cutting, I think we can manage for the next year or so until we can really fine-tune this thing. I don't think we're going to crash overnight. We have time to deal with this, a little bit of time. The biggest thing is just working together to try to make it work for everyone as much as possible. We're going to see some pain, no matter what. Basically, we relied on oil, but this is not just a $40 per barrel oil issue. The government overspent over the years. I believe that with all my heart. It's like kids with their hand in a candy jar, you know, they just got to keep getting it. I think they're going to have to pay a little more attention now. And this fiscal situation that we're in, I believe it's going to make people start paying attention. And then I believe we can make it work. There is going to be pain. We're just going to have to get ready for it. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson.
Yeah, it's going to take restraint. We've got to take a look at what we're doing in our spending, pick up that number. Dan's right in that we can't just do an across-the-board cut.
Hold on just a second. I believe we are having an emergency broadcast EMS signal right now. The blue light just came on, so
okay.
Hold on just a second, and we'll let that way you'll actually have an answer.
All right. How does that work?
At least I hope that's what it means, because otherwise we'll just have air silence.
Uh-huh.
Well, go ahead and continue your answer.
Because if we do across-the-board cuts, we could be damaging to those departments that provide the ability for us to utilize our natural resources to their full extent. He brought up fisheries as an example. But it's also in the state timber. We have foresters, and if we cut foresters, we can't get a state timber sale out the door. And I'm sure that it runs through a number of different departments. I think if the legislature gave the agencies a number, we want to reduce the budget by $300 million. They know where to cut the budget. They should be able to do that. Sitting as a legislator, I don't know what the nuances are in every one of the departments that we have, but they do. And I think that's where the efficiency would be had. We also need to continue to look at emerging technologies and see if there's more efficiency we can get in regards to permitting and just getting the forms out there and get them processed. That gets somewhat difficult. We have, if you want to relicense a tugboat for operations, the tugboat hasn't changed, the route hasn't changed, but from what I understand, it can cost thousands of dollars and takes a considerable amount of time to get that thing relicensed, and it shouldn't be that hard. And those are the type, if we're spending money doing that on something that is fairly straightforward, I don't even know if they do a boat inspection. I think it's just the licensing. You send them records, they look at them, and they send you back a license. But if that's really happening, we need to get more efficient at what we're doing. We need to spend less time and process more permits in a more efficient manner. But I do think that the agencies have the ability to tell the legislature where those cuts come best. But I think if we set that number, say $4 billion, we're not going above that. And let them come back to the legislature and say, well, this is where we can do it and how we can do it. I think they'll step up to the plate.
Okay, and we do have about 8 minutes left. So if you have a question, now is the time to call 225-9655 or 1-800-557-5723. And my next question is, energy is always an issue. What are your ideas for expanding energy opportunities for Southeast Alaska? And this time we'll start with Mr. Sievertson.
Energy in Southeast is hydro. We do have the availability for some wind generation and maybe some tidal generation. But really, the drift of it is our most renewable and usable resources are hydropower. The problem is when do you invest in that to bring it online? If you invest in it too early, the project won't pay for itself. The business plan won't pay for it. Right now, our load growth is probably staying pretty flat. We're managing our loads. I don't think we've burned any diesel in regards to needed power. We do it for maintenance and backup, that type of stuff. But we haven't run short. We just added an expansion to Swan Lake that will raise that reservoir and give us 20% more capacity in that, allowing us to run longer into the winter when we have less rainfall. We have looked at a Southeast IRP to try to figure out what the next project is. We want to make sure it's the right project, size right. But without a load growth, it's difficult to justify bringing that on. I think that we're going to have to burn a little bit of diesel before it pencils that we start putting a lot of money into a hydro site. But that's our next. We'll do a hydro site. I don't know which one it's going to be yet. There's a number of them that have been looked at. Southeast Alaska Power Agency has done a Lower Southeast IRP. There was one done by the state that by Black and Beach that did most of Southeast. There was a whole bunch of sites listed. Whether they're viable or not is a question. But it takes a long time to get these things developed. And with the roadless issues that we have in trying to construct them, we have some hurdles to overcome. And again, that's getting back to getting control of our resources so that we can get out of this situation where it makes it almost impossible to develop something. But hydro will be the next thing that we have in Southeast, and it'll come when we need the demand.
Okay. And Mr. Ortiz?
There's no question that in order for our economy to prosper, in order for businesses to have the opportunity to flourish, cheap, affordable power needs to be a part of that model. We are blessed by having access to water power here in Southeast Alaska. It's one of our, primary advantages that we have in terms of operating businesses in this region. I do think that it's incumbent upon a legislator, and it's incumbent upon groups that, like SEPA, that are not just a local group, but they're a regional group, that we make sure and do whatever we can to tie in to the power needs of our entire region. I think that we need to continue to look at perhaps providing a link from here in Ketchikan, from our island here in Revillagigedo, over to Metlakatla. They have potential power issues that they're looking at, and I think they'd be very much interested in tying into our power network. And I'm hoping that we can look for opportunities to make that happen in the future. Saxman and the Mahoney Lake Project is another area where we perhaps need to continue looking at the economics of making that project happen, so that Saxman can have can take advantage of their resource that they have. So I think one of the big issues is not so much what power source we're going to go to. I think that's determined. Water power is our asset. But one of the things we need to keep looking at is how can we connect our entire district and region. Petersburg's not in our political district, but how can we tie in southern Southeast Alaska, central Southeast Alaska, the communities in those areas, to the water resources that we have so that all the communities can prosper and benefit and be communities where businesses can prosper and benefit. And that's only going to bring added benefits to the entire region. So that's my vision, and I'm hoping that I can contribute to helping see that be carried out.
Thank you. And Mr. Shaw.
I found something with these gentlemen. I just can't argue. I agree with you totally on that. Hydro's it. There's nothing else really viable. I mean, wind's possible, but I'm not hearing a lot of good things about wind turbines as far as the cost and the money you can recoup from them, at least at this point. The only thing that I would add to those comments is, after, and hopefully we get our budget problems dealt with, we probably should sooner rather than later try to get a plan going. Construction costs are climbing so much all the time. If we don't get this kind of thing going now, construction costs are going to be double in a few years. It just makes it harder and so much more expensive. I think if we can get our ducks in a row again with our money situation, that's something I'd like to see. I'd like to see a little effort and a little time put into that soon, so we don't have to wait 10 years, pay an extra who knows how many millions to billions to make these projects happen. The longer we wait, the more it's going to cost us.
So one of the things is the financing of those. They used to have grant programs, and now they're low interest loan programs, and that's a debt upon a community that will last. And sometimes on some of the bigger projects, you want to run them out maybe 60 years and make them pencil. So it's tough for an individual community to put that type of dollars into a single project.
Right.
Okay, and we are pretty much out of time. I am going to give each candidate an opportunity for a brief closing statement, and we will start with Mr. Ortiz.
Thank you, Layla. It has been an honor and a privilege for me to be able to walk on the House floor in the Capitol building in Juneau as your state representative these past 2 years. Why is that the case? Because I've been allowed to represent the communities of this region, and that's what we are here, a collection of communities. The idea of community, the idea that people living together, working together, helping each other out, that's becoming more and more rare in our modern society. But we have it here still in Southeast Alaska, and I hope to be able to continue to be District 36 representative. It's an important election, no question about it. I firmly believe that my continuing to be able to serve in the district as your district representative is in the best interests of the district and of this community. When I look at the potential of this bipartisan coalition, when I look at what that would mean in terms of added benefits to coastal Alaska, to communities that exist here in District 36, I can honestly say that I will be part of a group that will, it'll be easy for me to continue to act in the best interest of District 36 and in the best interest of the state of Alaska. And that's why I'm asking for everyone's vote out there, because I think it's in your best interest that I continue to be able to serve as your district representative. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Sievertson?
Yeah, I'd like to thank Dan for his service. Anybody that runs for a public office, I appreciate them stepping up and doing that. But this is about your representative in the best position possible. Dan has made a case that there's a possibility for a bipartisan coalition. But the Republican majority has been in power for 20 years. And we'll have no reason to believe that they're not going to be in charge in the next session. Senator Stedman has been a big supporter of me. He needs somebody to work with in the House that's in the majority, and that's where I plan to be. We need a team. You know, it's worked in the past, and it'll work now. And it would be a privilege and an honor to represent you. But one of the things that I would ask is please, please get out and vote. That's the most important thing. Thank you.
Thank you. And Mr. Shaw, you get the last word.
Thank you, Leila. I just wanted to point out, basically, it's what I call and my party calls my contract with Alaska. That's the best way to sum up my involvement at this point. And that is to restore and protect the PFD. That's such an issue with me, with my party, with the Constitution Party. We do not feel a statewide income tax or sales tax is needed to get our budget squared away. We just need to tighten our belts more and use the finances that we have. We still have money coming in from oil revenues. We're not drying up yet. So I am not willing at all to vote for a statewide income tax. I'd like to restore and protect our privacy rights. I see them. I see us losing them pretty quickly. Nationwide, statewide, everywhere. I want to protect life from conception to natural death. That's something we probably haven't touched on much in this election. It's on a lot of people's minds, folks that I've talked to since I've started this campaign. I wanted to make sure that was out there. And comprehensive election reform. I think there needs to be some work there. Aside from that, getting our budget back in order is my main goal, and I want to see it happen. I would appreciate your vote, and I humbly ask for your vote November 8th. Thank you.
Thank you. And that wraps up this evening's call-in show on KRBD. I've been your host, Layla Carey. Thanks to Joe Kovac, who volunteered to help out on the phones, to the listeners who submitted questions, and thanks to our candidates, Bob Sievertson, Ken Shaw, and Dan Ortez. Remember to vote in the general election on November 8th, and stay tuned for Wednesday night Rockin' Blues, coming up next.